Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And a very pleasant good afternoon as Steve continues vacay. We continue our best of week on the Steve Jones Show. And Sean Carey here in the Sunbury Motors Studio. Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia. On the Strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Hey, you can find us on social media. We're on Facebook. Give us a like. We're on Twitter. You can follow us at SteveJonesPSU. And our email, SteveJones@WKOK.com. Subscribe to our podcast. Big thank you to our podcast listeners. Seeing a nice, healthy jump in numbers over the past week or so. So if you have not subscribed yet, please do. It's our Steve Jones Show podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcast app, and Google Play. All you do is search Steve Jones Show, and then hit that little subscribe button. And that's it. Then we drop the shows right to your smartphone and tablet. And if you're on vacation this week like Steve, you can catch up with previous shows. Go to our podcast archive page at SteveJonesShow.com. We have over 3 months of shows there on the website. So we are with you live till 5. Then we'll have the late-day news roundup. Zach Klein will be at the anchor desk tonight, 5:06. And then we'll head to Citizens Bank Park for Phillies baseball on WKOK tonight. Game 3, the 4-game set between the Phillies and the Dodgers. Wow, last night, pretty nuts. Philly up 6-1, thanks to early homers by Scott Kingery and Bryce Harper. Vince Velasquez didn't take him long to rack up 6 strikeouts early. Then you knew the Dodgers were going to eventually come back. They take the lead. Hector Neris blows his 4th save of the season. And right after giving up a 3-run homer in the top of the 9th, he plunks David Freese, gets tossed, Gabe Kapler gets tossed, and then the Phillies get 3 runs of their own in the bottom half of the 9th inning, thanks to a walk-off double by Bryce Harper, his first walk-off hit as a Philly. And it was an eventful game last night at Citizens Bank Park, as the Phillies defeated the Dodgers by a score of 9-8. Nick Pivetta will be on the mound tonight for the Phillies. We'll have on deck at 6:30. And then first pitch, 7:05 here on WKOK on 1070 AM. And it was funny, last night before the Phillies batted in the bottom half of the 9th inning, the game was also on MLB Network last night. Bob Costas said that Phillies bullpen of late has not been populated by firemen, but by arsonists. 100% complete agreement from everyone in Phillies Nation. Some could say that, too, about the starting rotation outside of Aaron Nola. But that's another topic. By the way, the Phillies and Dodgers have an afternoon day game tomorrow. So we'll then be off till Friday. And we'll cap off our best of week on Friday with lots of great Penn State football conversation with current Tampa Bay Buck, former Nittany Lions offensive lineman Donovan Smith, Mark Brennan, fightonstate.com will be on, and also we'll hear from head coach James Franklin. We'll do one of two things on Friday with Coach Franklin. We're either going to play back some of his audio from February during National Letter of Intent Day, or if we have a chance to get his audio from Big Ten Football Media Days, we'll have that. So either one or the other with Coach Franklin on Friday. Either way, you will hear from the coach. Today on our Best Of, you will hear a little later on, we'll have more baseball conversation with Sweeney Murdy, the Yankees beat reporter for The Fan in New York City. Also, author Jeff Perlman next hour will recap Steve's interview with Jeff from last fall, talk about his USFL book, and more Phillies conversation with Kevin Franzen. We had a chance to talk to Kevin right after the start of the Phillies season. So we'll get that first interview with Steve and Kevin to wrap up the show today. So earlier this year, Dave Cicchini was announced as the new head coach for Bucknell Bison football. The Bison will start their season at the end of August at Temple. Of course, you'll be able to hear all the games with Doug Birdsong and Kevin Herr on Eagle 107 at 107.3. Here is Steve and Dave Cicchini.
Thanks, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
All right, let's talk about the Valpo experience. You took over a program at Valpo that with all due respect to previous staffs, just was treading water and couldn't get anywhere. What kind of rebuilding job did it take there, and did it need to have a culture adjustment?
It definitely needed a culture adjustment, but more so than that, it just needed a sense of direction. You know, they had had some coaches that had been in there that really didn't kind of understand the Division I FCS way of doing football and how to have success at this level. So we really started out by hammering away. The biggest issue they had was a facility standpoint. They really were lacking in facilities. So I was able to go out and energize the alumni and get them excited about the program again and to kind of open up their wallets, write some checks, and that helped us start to catch up to the rest of the league just from a facility standpoint, weight room and locker room and things like that really had kind of fallen down closer to the Division III level of competitiveness. So that was really the key that allowed us to attract some better recruits, some higher caliber recruits, and I think we did some really nice things on offense and defense and changed that culture within the team in terms of the competitiveness, and that was kind of the recipe for success there.
Dave, what was it about the Bucknell job when it became open that made you say, you know what, that fits me?
Yeah, that's a great question. I started out in the Patriot League, so I knew it very well. I played at Lehigh University. I coached. I was before I became the head coach at Valparaiso, I was the offensive coordinator at Lehigh. And I'd also coached at Harvard in the Ivy League. So I've gotten to know the unique challenges that schools in the Ivy League and the Patriot League face that are a little bit different than most of the rest of the Division I FCS landscape. And I'll be honest, I've come to really love and embrace the type of student athlete that you have at these institutions. I mean, Bucknell, they've got great kids on the football team. I mean, you can get behind them, you can root for them, you want them to be successful. And it's somewhat of a sad state of affairs in Division I college football, but a lot of coaches at this level don't particularly enjoy coaching the players that they coach. It's just there's a disconnect that's there, and that is not the case at a school like Bucknell, where you just love every interaction that you have with a player. You can have a conversation with them that doesn't necessarily have to evolve around football, and they have other interests that are out there, and their heart's in the right place, and they're at a school for the right reasons, and they don't feel quite the sense of entitlement that's out there that a lot of major college schools, you know, sometimes that's the expectation of a player going into there. So I think that's the first thing that really attracted me to a place like Bucknell is I knew I would get a chance to have that daily interaction with the student athlete that I know would be really rewarding for me.
What were some of the important elements when you're forming a staff? Because that staff is going to be an extension of you. It's also going to be your liaison with the players on this team. So what were the elements you were looking at when you formed a staff, both philosophically and personally?
Yeah. Well, first off, I wanted them to be smart, smarter than me. a bunch of guys.
That's how I formed the show. That's why I got Sean.
No, it's something that, you need that. When you have intelligent players that you're coaching, you need an intelligent staff as well. And so I wanted a good group of guys that certainly know their X's and O's and have experience, but also they're great educators. They have to have that ability to communicate those ideas that you have, the philosophy of the program, and be able to echo that and get that instilled amongst the position groups. So I wanted guys that were good educators, great communicators, great motivators, and also a lot of guys who have had experience, like I have, coaching this type of student athlete.
All right, let's get to the facility part. You mentioned at Valpo, and my experience with Valpo would be through the basketball facilities, because obviously I would not have a football opportunity to announce a game there. How do you feel about Bucknell's facilities? Are they on track? Is there something that on your wish list you'd like to see more of? Because obviously anything takes time.
Sure. Yeah, I think that this school has an awful lot going for it. I think if you look, everything's relative. You know, is this have the facilities that Penn State has? It absolutely doesn't. But it's all relative to the rest of your competition. So when you're looking at the other Patriot League schools like Colgate, which certainly was at the top of the conference this year, and Lehigh and Lafayette, other schools in Pennsylvania, those are your benchmarks. And I think definitely we fare very, very well when it comes to from a facility standpoint compared to some of these other schools in our league. Do we have everything that everybody else has? No, but just about any school in our conference can point the finger at another school in the conference and say, well, they have this and we don't. We may have this and they don't, but they have something else that we don't have. So there does exist a fair amount of parity. You know, on my wish list, I would love to have an indoor turf facility. That's something that would help us moving forward, especially, you know, in the January and February months where there's a lot of snow and a lot of cold weather that's out there. But again, you've got a great stadium here. We've got a great football locker room. We've got a great facility here in the Clark that I think is second to none in the conference. So, but by no means are we at the bottom of the barrel.
When anybody comes in, obviously, at the point that you did, the recruiting part now, you're probably in the mode of having to re-recruit a couple of players, also looking at a couple of guys that you were looking at before. Where are you in the recruiting part?
Yeah, so we've got a chance to contact our staff and talked with the entire incoming class, incoming freshmen, had some great conversations with them. There are still a couple, not many, but there are a couple of prospects that are out there that we're still actively trying to get to join this year's class. So it may grow by one or two as we finish things up here over the course of the next couple of weeks. And then, of course, we're just actually trying to play catch-up, which is crazy to say this, but you're trying to play catch-up on next year's group of recruits because it seems with the early signing period in December, Everybody's just accelerated things. And so in January, you have a lot of Division I FCS programs that are out there already turning their eyes to the junior class, and we haven't been able to do that yet. So we are a little behind, and we need to play some catch-up in that regard.
Yeah, it gets to that point because I know in my basketball experience, which is now followed up by football experience with what they do with the early signing period, you almost feel like if you don't really get, 80%+ of your signees in place in the early signing period, you feel like you're playing from behind 2 years from behind.
Right, exactly, because you're spending a lot of, for that second signing period, you're spending a lot of your time and energy working with seniors as opposed to juniors.
And you feel like, oh, great, I'm doing this, I'm wasting capital here. What is the potential of Bucknell football, and what's the potential of Patriot League football? Because obviously the FCS has a big playoff model. Does Bucknell and does the Patriot League have what it takes to be a regular part of that model?
I think absolutely, and I think Colgate proved that to a degree with the success that they had this year. There's no question that there are challenges in this league that these other, CAA conferences, the Missouri Valley, you see their conference in North Dakota State, the dominance that they've had. You do have some challenges that those other conferences don't have. The fact of not being able to redshirt, with the exception of medical reasons, that does provide an extra layer of challenge. Having a roster cap that we have in our conference that other conferences don't have, that makes a difference. So you have several things that make it more challenging to have success, but by no means can that prohibit that success. Colgate did a great job dealing with that and having success in the playoffs and having a great year. And some of these schools in the Patriot League, even without scholarships, had had success in the playoffs. And so it's definitely possible. There's enough that these schools, and Bucknell in particular, can offer to a young, you know, junior as he's looking for his next step in college. It's such an attractive school from an academic standpoint and from a campus life and so many things beyond just the football experience. And that's not the case with a lot of other schools that are out there. So, you know, we may have certain hurdles that other conferences don't have, but we also do have some advantages that some of these other conferences don't have. So I see it as being a challenge, but certainly an attainable result.
Finally, Dave, what is it about the job of coaching that when you get up and get ready to go in the day, you can't wait to get to your office, whether the office happens to have a phone in it or whether the office happens to be out in the field?
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, you know, a lot of that this day and age is spent more in the office than out in the practice field. But I do revert back to you have to love the players that you're coaching day in and day out. It starts with that. I mean, everybody wants to win football games on Saturdays in the fall. I'm no different. I'm that type A competitive person who's always looking for the extra edge. But you only get so many opportunities throughout the year to prove yourself. You're going to win or you're going to lose on a Saturday in fall based off of all the cumulative efforts that you've done the entire season, and it's all of that day-to-day interaction, those day-to-day challenges that you have. You know, tomorrow morning we'll be out there at 6 a.m. out on the field getting after it, and that, you know, is going to go a long way into having our success in those Saturdays this fall. And yeah, I just love every single one of those interactions, whether it's in a meeting room or just sitting down and having lunch with one of our players. That's what keeps you going, knowing that you're fighting the good fight, so to speak. And that's why I do what I do.
As time goes, we'll get into philosophy, but I want to thank you for the time you gave us today. We really look forward to working with you as the years go by.
Great. I'm looking forward to it as well, Steve. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. He is the new head football coach at Bucknell, and certainly hoping that he will do a great job, and that is Dave Cicchini, and we'll look forward to working with him before they get to their spring game. This is where he'll, you know, you talk about those early morning workouts. They'll get the spring practice. We'll get him back on then. And it's another interview where Sean comes out really well. And also, I mean, to be honest with you, Sean, there was one question in there that was sort of in code about the color analyst.
Oh. Well, they'll have to deal with him sooner or later.
Well, you know, this might be one of those things where I just pulled Dave aside and said, you and I just need to talk. I'll do most of the talking. I just want to tell you, know, Dave, if you're still listening right now, you're going to love your play-by-play guy. Birdsong's awesome. We'll talk about the rest of it. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
And Bucknell is going to kick off their season August 31st against Temple. By the way, Bucknell and Temple, they played each other from 1927 to 1970, with the winner receiving the old Shoe Trophy. And, of course, we'll have that game and all the Bucknell Bison football matchups and men's basketball, too, on Eagle 107 at 107.3 with Doug Birdsong. And, of course, Kevin will be along for the ride for Orange and Blue football. All right, so our best of week continues next half hour. We'll replay an excellent baseball conversation between Steve and Yankees beat writer Sweeney Murdy from The Fan in New York City. That's coming up right after a check of headlines from CBS on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. For nearly 100 years, Purdy Insurance has been your locally owned, family-operated source for insurance products. With a staff of over 20 and partnerships with some of the industry's most trusted companies, Purdy has the experience and resources to get the job done. Whether you need personal, home, and auto, or complex business insurance solutions, Purdy will help you navigate through the process. Call today at 570-286-5855, or better yet, stop in their Sunbury office to see what Purdy Insurance can do for you.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street, Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Steve's back with us on Monday. Sean Carey, this is our best of week, replaying some of the great interviews from months gone by, including an excellent baseball conversation that Steve had with Yankees beat writer from The Fan, New York City, Sweeney Murdy.
Steve, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I really, really enjoy getting a chance to hear you every now and again on the satellite as I'm driving around all fall and winter, and it's a pleasure to chat with you now.
Let's start with Universal DH for both leagues. Universal DH, look, I remember when the first DH Ron Bloomberg came up. So it's been over. I mean, look, it's been forever, 45 plus years now that this rule has been in play in the American League. Obviously, you're covering an American League team every day. DH, no DH.
Full DH. And you're talking to somebody who grew up in the Harrisburg area and watched Phillies baseball growing up. So I watched National League ball. And, you know, growing up, it was all about, yeah, I love National League ball. I've watched the Yankees pretty much every day for the last 18, going on 19 years now. And not just that, Steve, but when you come on the fact that when I watch pitchers hit, I just realize how bad they are at it. And it's really not fun it's not enjoyable, it's not entertaining in any way to watch them do it at the professional level. Pitchers are not asked to hit after high school. There's a DH in every professional league, and you end up in interleague games now asking the American League pitchers to hit for the first time in forever. Even the National League pitchers who do it on a regular basis, they just aren't good enough at it to make it something that needs to be done for the sake of tradition. A lot of sports have evolved over the years, different things, different specializations. Football used to be you play both ways. Well, that stopped. There's just different things that happen in sports along the way, and I no longer find any real value in a pitcher batting for the National League. I'm over the strategy element of it. These guys don't last long enough in games anyway for it to be a major factor anymore. You're essentially pinch hitting for them the second time they come up. Well, so what difference does it make? You're losing one at bat a game, maybe two. I don't see the real impact. I feel it's one of these things that people yell and scream about it until it happens, and then nobody will care.
Pitchers hit 136 last year in the National League. Overall, they hit 136. DHs hit 249 last year. Look, and the strategy part, I always love, there's so much more strategy. Okay,
yeah.
Runner on first, nobody out. Pitcher's up. I think he might punt, Sweeney. So much for playing along with the manager.
Oh, my gosh. Do you remember... how many highlight reels have you seen of managers thinking? I get it, and I enjoy, sure. Listen, I've been around baseball a long time now, and I enjoy talking to people about the game and thinking about the game, but nobody wakes up the next morning and says, hey, did you see that sack bunt or did you see that double switch? It's really just you know, they're talking about entertainment value, and to me, there's just no entertainment value in watching a pitcher hit anymore. It's passed them by, because they're not asked to do it. That's the thing, you know.
Right.
You get to the major leagues, and all of a sudden, you're asked to hit against the best pitchers in baseball when you haven't been asked to do it since high school. It's not fair.
Right, and I'm going into my 14th season of doing the State College Spikes games here, and it, you know, they have the DH, and the Spikes are a St. Louis Cardinals affiliate.
Yeah,
they're using the DH
exactly.
at this level because they want to look at the pitcher's pitch, and they want to use the DH to evaluate a hitter.
Yeah, and
so you're not asked to do it.
I've seen, and I don't love the idea. I've seen two pretty significant injuries to pitchers on the base paths.
Yes.
And I don't think that that's a good enough reason in and of itself, but it's an extra benefit of it. You know, you're paying a lot of money to pitch the ball. You know, running the bases is different. I understand, you know, it's not the same thing. And I tried to tell this to Ron Darling yesterday. I said, you know, Masahiro Tanaka he pulled two hamstrings last year trying to tag up from third base and score on a sacrifice fly.
Right.
I thought it was a bad decision to send him because that one run wasn't worth the help of my pitcher for a month. But I find myself taking the Joes versus Pros, taking the Joes side here. I said, shouldn't the guy be able to just run? And Darling snapped right back at me. He said, it's different. It's not the same thing when you're trying to sprint home in a game situation like that off the bases. Running the bases is just different. And this is from a guy who played in the major leagues for a long time. I'll take his word for it.
Right, exactly. But there's another part to it as well. Mike Mussina, I think, gets into the Hall of Fame in part because he ate up a lot of innings, he won a lot of games, but he also did it in a DH league where you're not facing essentially seven hitters in the lineup, you're facing nine. And I think that's also a consideration in this.
I would even go so far as to say, like six and a half hitters. You know, that's it's the way pitchers attack the bottom of that lineup in the National League. I was a big proponent of Mussina as a Hall of Famer. I watched the final 8 years of his career with the Yankees up close. And, DH League, what he was able to do, it's certainly a big consideration there. There's, you know, the just look at, Curt Schilling has a tremendous Hall of Fame case for him. But just look at the difference in his career ERA, National League to American League. It's pretty significant, and it's not a knock against Schilling and nothing to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. It's just that, you know, the American League produces more runs. And to me, this argument, Steve, isn't about producing more offense for the sake of entertainment. It's simply the fact that you're sending up these helpless people, you know, once every nine turns. What are you expecting here? It's
right.
You're just trying to get past that at bat so the next real hitter can come up. I just think that we've come to the point where it's not worth keeping around anymore.
The average time between pitches increased to an all-time high of 24.1 seconds last year. How do you feel about a 20-second pitch clock?
I'm not opposed to it. I think I think what's going to happen is it'll have an overall effect on a lot of guys because, you know, for me, you're going to have these guys who maybe take 30 seconds trying to get to within, let's say they take 25 seconds. They have to now pitch within 20. I think the guy who takes 15 to 20 seconds is still going to be just as aware of the clock, and maybe it speeds him up a few more seconds. The time between two pitches seems to be the biggest thing, and, I like the idea of the clock. I'm fine with it, and I know that there's going to be some unintended consequences of it.
Right.
As there are any rule change, you're going to wait to see how it plays out, and then see, this is the way it works now. Yeah. But I think that the biggest drag on the game in time is the time between pitches. And I think there's a couple of big reasons for it. When there's guys on base, it's a lot about sign stealing and trying to get the signals from the catcher to the pitcher. Yeah, I mean, that just eats up so much time. But another part of it, I think, is that, I think guys are they're trying to throw every pitch as hard as they can. And when they do that, I think they're trying to conserve energy between pitches and trying to gear up for that next throw it as hard as I can fastball. And that's something that I think is you know, it's really more of the way the guys are throwing. And the pitch clock is probably necessary for that, because I just think guys are catching their breath every pitch and trying to get through it as much as they can.
The three batter minimum. You use the phrase, and I think everyone knows who listens to the show. I've talked many times on different topics about unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the three batter minimum brings with it a list of unintended consequences, which I thought the four of you did a great job of outlining last night.
One of them to me was, is it strictly three batters? Because what if a guy comes in and gets a double play ball?
Right.
You know, he gets two outs facing one batter. If a guy gets picked off, does that lessen, does that guy gets caught stealing?
If you get the last out of the game, do you have to face the next game, the first two batters?
But you know what? That's funny, but I just thought of this morning when I was thinking more about this rule. What if if it's two outs in the eighth inning, and I bring in a pitcher if I bring in a left-hander to get the next left-hander out, he gets the third out of the inning. I now want to bring in my closer for the ninth inning. So do I now have to let the other guy pitch the first two batters of that inning, of that ninth inning, because it's a three-batter minimum? I think if we're going to implement that, the inning has to be allowed to reset. The end of the inning has to be allowed to reset that rule. It should only be, if you're going to go there, it can only be within the inning. Because even if it's not a closer situation, what if I bring a guy in to get an out, he gets one out, I have to keep him in for two more, but then my team's five runs in their turn at bat, and it changes the dynamic of who I want to pitch the rest of, to the next inning. And the other thing that I think has to be fair, and I got this from a pitcher. One of my close friends in the game is a left-hander named Randy Choate, who played for years
in
the big league as a lefty specialist. And he says, what happens when I come in to pitch face the left-hander? What's the first thing the manager does? He pinch hits the right-hander. So this is, if you're going to enforce this pitcher has to face these batters, you can't take every advantage away from him. You have to let the announced hitter bat and at least give him that first left-on-left matchup. If you want to pinch it, if you stack two lefties, you want to pinch it for the second lefty, okay, that's fair. You haven't announced the guy. That's regular rules. But if you've announced this batter coming up and then a left-handed pitcher comes in, you can't just pull him back and then send up a right-hander and make that move, which we've seen happen plenty of times.
Talking about expanding the roster to 26, I'll take it one step further. I'd like to see it be maybe 27 or 28, and here's my reasoning. No expansion to 40. Okay, don't do that. Keep it at 28 all season as a number. And I also like capping the number of pitchers on there at a dozen. How do you feel about that rule?
I feel like 26 is fine for the regular season.
Okay. I can go with that, too. That's fine.
I like their idea that they want to expand to 28 in September and kind of make it like a, or even if you expand beyond 28, you have an active 28 and it's a taxi squad type of situation, a practice squad or whatever you want to call it. Instead of this team has 39 guys and this team has 33 guys and, you've got six left-handed pitchers in the bullpen and you're going to bring in one for every out from the sixth inning on, that it creates absurdities in the game, and it's not fun for anybody to go through. But yeah, the thing I keep thinking about, though, like as we go through these rules changes, I think I brought up this point yesterday. I can't remember if it was in the meeting of the show. These guys are, this is what happens when we get older, Steve. What the people are trying to do to play the game, they're just trying to win the game. They don't care how long it takes. They don't care if it takes an extra 30 seconds to get the signal from the catcher to the pitcher to make sure I got the right pitch. They're fine with that because they have one job, it's to win the game. And that's
right.
We're trying to make it more entertaining. And there has to be a balance there, no doubt about it. But the people involved in the game aren't concerned. They're trying to manipulate all the rules to their best advantage. And, when we talk about unintended consequences, that's what happens when you set down rules. People are always going to try to find a way to get around it.
Which I'll bring up something. It's not in the rules, but it's something that was used a lot this year, especially by Tampa Bay more than anybody else, and that's the opener. Brian Kenny, who is very analytics-driven, and it's not that Brian doesn't have great points. Brian does make great points. And John Smoltz is always funny because he's the get off my lawn guy. You know? Which makes it interesting. Now, it's never pointed out that Tampa Bay's record with the opener was under 500. that never comes up. Have you noticed that? But what do you think of that? I mean, I don't mind trying something, but as an old-time baseball guy, it doesn't quite wash with me. And I just watched a team win the World Series that had legit starters.
Well, and that proves your point that, you know, you're still going to get to, you know, you're the best teams are still going to be put in the best position if they have legit starters. Tampa Bay, they've explained it to me, you know, over the course of the year, many times, really what went down. It was, they had a lot of things happen to them that forced them into that situation.
That's right.
A lot of guys got hurt, and the people that were in line behind them, the starting depth, was all young players that probably wouldn't have survived the innings crunch that would have been forced on them if they had to keep making starts every 5 days and throw 5, 6, 7 innings. So they had to get a little creative to save the innings number on their depth guys, because when those guys went down, they would have been searching, you know, elsewhere for pitchers, and they don't have anywhere else to go. So it was born out of necessity, not, let's figure out how we can reinvent the wheel here. And it worked to a degree for them. The team won 90 games, but remember, they also, the irony of a Cy Young Award winner in the American League, given to the best starting pitcher. And
yes,
he wasn't the guy who was pitching one or two innings. He was going out there every 5 days. But his injury earlier in the year and some innings concerns was part of the reason they needed to, you know, worry about this in all the other starts that they were dealing with. So I don't love the idea of reacting to a rule after you saw it happen one time to one extreme with one team. If it becomes a widespread problem, then okay, we can work on this and think about this. But what are you supposed to do? Force a guy to pitch a certain number? You're risking health and all kinds of other things when this happens.
Yes. Yeah, no question. And one final question, I'll let you go because I know you're really busy, and it's going to deal with the Yankees. Obviously, Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are still out there, and Jason Benetti, who does the White Sox games, he and I were talking at shoot-around today because he's going to do the game on ESPN tonight. And obviously, Machado visited Chicago. That aside, if the Yankees make no other move, then they don't go with Harper, they don't go with Machado. They've made so many other moves during this offseason. How impressed are you by what Brian Cashman was able to do? Because, I mean, they still won 100 games last year. It just turned out there was a buzzsaw that was in front of them.
The last 2 years, that buzzsaw has been there. And, you know, the Yankees are measured by a certain standard, but we have to remember that the last 2 years, they have lost to teams better than them during the regular season, but, you know, decisively better than them in the regular season. It's been a slow build. And you're right, it's going underappreciated because it's not Harper, Machado, it's not spend hundreds of millions to get these top three guys. You know, the biggest move they made was getting James Paxton from Seattle. It happened
Absolutely.
Very early in the off season, and so it's gotten kind of lost. And he's also not viewed by a more casual fan as, you know, your Kershaw, Verlander, Scherzer type of ace. But there are so many people around the game who think this was a fabulous move by the Yankees to strike early and get James Paxton, who is trending up. His injury history has been mostly of the freak injury variety, not chronic elbow shoulder type things. And, you know, I can't tell you, Steve, how many people I talked to over the winter that are always, and this is people from around baseball, you know, who always tell me that, you know, Brian Cashman is really good at his job despite being able to throw a lot of money at problems. And when you look at Paxton, that's another classic example of the type of move that people love about it. It's going to take a while for that to really show itself, but Luis Severino, if he's ready to really make that next step, he's already one of the top 10 pitchers in the game. If he's ready to jump into being the top 5 or 6 guys, you know, you can see where the Yankees' slow build the last couple of years might end up, you know, getting them over the hump and getting them over the Red Sox. You know, that's the thing that I think has bothered most Yankee fans that I know or deal with on social media or whatever. It's that Harper and Machado, they believe, could be the guys who definitively put the Yankees over the top and crush the Red Sox before the season even starts. Well, in this way, the Red Sox are really good. You know, they were great last year, and they're still really good. You're not going to make any move that's going to crush them before the season starts. You got to put your best team out there and play out 162, and just like you always do, and see what happens. I think their infield is a little shaky because of, you know, Tulowitzki. You're counting on a guy bouncing back after missing an entire year, and you're one injury away from an infield that isn't your best, and defensively not your best. So I'm a little worried about that, and I do see that, you know, you got a couple of and ifs in your rotation, but overall still a good rotation, really good lineup. With maybe some bounce back from some other players, namely Gary Sanchez, and maybe Aaron Judge doesn't get hit by pitch and miss 7 weeks. This all helps your offense. They're a really good team, and I don't ever like making the predictions every year of how many wins are going to get, who's going to win the division.
Right.
You know, all I want to say, Steve, when I get to the opening day and say, do I think this team is good enough to win 95 to 100 games?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I do. Last year, I did. And the rest of it's, you know, the rest of it's just guessing. So why, you know, to me, that's not worth it. Are they good enough to make a run? Yes.
Yeah.
That's all I can tell you.
Always a pleasure. Love talking baseball or anything with you. Great to talk with you again, Sweeney.
Steve, you're one of my favorites, one of my early mentors, and thank you so much for your kindness over the years and all the kind words and the build-up. So pleasure to join you and all the fans in State College. I still consider it home and, or you know, a piece of home. So hi to everybody out there, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, my friend. Great to hear you. Always doing great work. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.